House Interim Task Force on Seniors. It has been pointed out by some that it appears that in order to serve on this particular task force, you must be over 50. I don't know whether that fits for some of the ladies present here, but I know that for the gentleman on my left and the chair, it fits by at least a couple of years. Without further attempts at trying to add some humor to a topic that is sometimes often short of humor, let's get on and move to our agenda and open a work session on the adoption of the task force rules. I believe, members, you all have a copy of the rules, or have been had a copy of the rules distributed to you here or somewhere in the past. And so the chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, is this the reason we have this in very large print?
I would hope so.
I like it. I appreciate that, and
we could make note to the staff that it would be all right in any of the materials that come out to this committee that we go up a couple of sizes on the print. I mean,
okay, duly noted, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the draft rule.
Representative Nolan moves the adoption of the draft rules on seniors, on the House, for the House Interim Task Force on Seniors. Are there any questions or is there any discussion on the rules? We would appreciate in the rules that the rules do provide for subcommittees, and in light of the fact that we have a rather healthy agenda, I think, for the task force, and in light of the fact that the speaker would like to keep the cost down if and where possible, there's reason to believe that we may go to a couple of task forces to deal with some specific topics to bring material back to the committee at large. So with no discussion, is there any objection to the adoption of the rules? Hearing none, so ordered. And with this, then, I would like to introduce to members of the committee our able staff, Annetta Mullins, the assistant staff for this committee, and Sandy Fielcerca, our the brains of the committee. And she will, where possible, try to keep us straight, and where possible, try to keep the chair organized. She does not claim to be able to do that, but she will try where possible. And if you have not, in your historical past, had the good pleasure or good fortune of serving on a committee where Sandy has been the staff, you will certainly be pleased in this committee, because she is just an outstanding staff member and will work just as hard as she possibly can to accommodate all of your needs and all of your interests. So,
you're kind.
You're being set up.
Okay.
Come on.
Okay.
So, And I have, we'll discuss a little bit at the end the review and discussion of the proposed task force work plan. And there'll be some items and agenda there that we'll include. So without any further ado, unless some of you have some questions. And oh, by the way, I have a question for our staff. Why?
Why?
Do you want us on a piece of paper to put our Social Security number where everybody and his brother can see it?
You wish for it not to be here. Don't put it here.
Okay.
They know who you are.
I know that.
I know where you live, too.
I know that, too. I tried to increase the mileage one time to its actual miles. And it says in the book, 500. And they turned down my request.
Hmm.
So they made me want, they wanted me to do some, you know, special sort of thing to get the other however many miles it is. So I know they know everything there is to know about
it.
Okay.
Or you get something like
what?
How many miles?
It's about 550 miles.
550 round trip, yeah.
Beats by 460.
Yeah.
Well, I had to get it up there to be at least almost 100 miles more than yours. They wouldn't let me. And because of, I would say that because of the indicator representative guard's 460 and my 500. If and where possible, on the other committee that Representative Gerard chairs, that he has so kindly, I think, allowed me to be on that committee with him, we will try, where possible, to back-to-back these those two committee meetings. And since we both travel the furthers of any of the members on the committee, and since we are very conservative in nature and want to save the state's travel money, we will try if we're possible to do that so that we don't have duplicate assignments. With that, then, I need to close the work session and open a public hearing, informational meeting, on review, first of all, of the Department of Human Services, and Dr. Goldberg, Director of DHS, is here to give us that review. And following that, we will have discussions from the Assistant Director to Seniors and People with Disabilities, James Tace, and then Judy Moore Peterson will give us a discussion on the forecasting that the agency is not undertaking. Dr. Goldberg.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to do two things. One, since I am new to the directorship of the Department of Human Services, to introduce myself to you. And secondly, because I know that varying members of the committee have had varying experience with DHS, just to provide a brief overview of the department so that you have a sense of where issues around seniors and people with disabilities fit in. And my punchline around that is everywhere within the department, because everything is interrelated. I've been director of the Department of Human Services since November 1. It's a wonderful challenge and really important work, and I really relish in it. I have a real passion for human services. I've spent my career in the human services world trying to figure out how to better organize and deliver health care to vulnerable populations, and that's what I hope to be able to continue to do within DHS. I'm a family doc, and so I come at these issues from a number of perspectives. As a family physician, I've cared for many of the patients that we serve, the clients that we serve, whether they're seniors in nursing homes or low-income individuals needing health care out in the community. I've provided medical care for them and understand, as best as I can, many of the issues facing our clients. I've been a business partner with the state. I've run organizations that have been business partners with the state and as a result understand the importance of collaborative business relationships and how to we all need to work together to get the job done. And for the last couple of years, many of you know me through my work in the Office of Health Policy, and so I also have an understanding of the policy implications about all of this and the decisions and the policy implications of those decisions. What the Department of Human Services does is extremely important to the state and to the people in the state. We touch people everywhere in the state of, you know, every age, in every geographic locale. We are organized, as you have on your sheet of paper, into what we call five clusters, and they're really five operational units. There is an administrative services group that provides the administrative services to the department, contracting, information services, et cetera. We have the Children, Adults, and Families, which provides both TANF support to needy families as well as child welfare, child protection services. Seniors and people with disabilities, which we'll be hearing about today from James. We have a finance policy unit, which is really our budget shop, as well as doing policy analysis, and a health services cluster, which is comprised of the health plan, OMAP, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and the Public Health Division that provides public health services for the state. And the reason I introduced that to you today is because I hope that when you think about issues around seniors and people with disabilities, that you come away with an understanding that those are issues that really cross across every place on this organizational chart and throughout the Department of Human Services. As an two examples, one would be long-term care. Much of what's done and paid for in long-term care is actually paid for out of our Medicaid program. Yet, long-term care is certainly one of the huge issues facing seniors in our state. And so as we have an ever-growing older population in the state and we're looking at increasing long-term care needs, that's not just an issue for seniors and people with disabilities, it's an issue for the health plan as well. Likewise, mental health issues, which are certainly issues that cut across every age, every place in this state, these aren't issues that just reside within our Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, but it cuts across the issues around seniors. And what that really gets me to is, you know, some of having been on the job now for 6 weeks, some of the issues that, you know, I hope we'll be addressing at a high level. And those are, number one, transparency, that I think we need to have a transparent organization that provides the information that you need as policymakers, that in an understandable format so that we can work together on the decisions that need to be done, that provides the information to our clients in an accessible and an understandable format, and that presents the information within our own organization in a transparent and open way. I think what that transparency does is help us meet a second goal, which is accountability and stewardship, that we have an obligation as an organization to do the best that we can with the resources that we have, to be able to account for them, to be good stewards of those, and to work towards what's a third issue, which is really being an outcomes, to drive what we do based on outcomes. That by having transparency, by having that accountability, where we need to drive that for, too, is to outcomes. That I think why we're all here is to get better outcomes, to improve the lives of the individuals that we serve. We have to be clear about what those outcomes are, be able to measure them, and understand when we're meeting them, when we're not being them, meeting them, and be accountable to them. We also have to look to integration of services, just as I indicated. The issues around seniors are not just about seniors themselves. They're issues about how we deliver mental health care in our communities, how we deal with issues of substance abuse, issues of the health plan and health care. They're issues about our families that touch our child welfare programs, indeed, grandparents and others, our foster parents in our communities. And so these issues all cut across each other, and we need to address them in that way. The main issue that you're going to be looking at are issues around seniors, and James Taze will talk to you more about that. But from where I sit right now, I think that the big issue that's going to be facing us is the growing demographic of those of us, Representative Jensen, that are over 50. And it's an issue for those of us who are below 50 as well. It's an issue for all of us. But there's certainly a growing number of individuals in this state over 50, and our ability to meet the needs of those individuals is going to be a challenge. Certainly, long-term care is going to be one of the biggest challenges. We have a tremendous amount to be, I think, proud of successes that we've had in the state. I was talking to the Regional Secretary for Health and Human Services for the country yesterday, and he was remarking about the successes Oregon has had in long-term care, with the fact that we're way ahead of most other states in terms of our ability to have many people at home in the community getting the services that they need in community-based programs and not in institutional care. We led the nation in that, and his remark was that the rest of the country is now looking to model that, as they're facing some of the same financial constraints that states are, how they're going to look to pay for long-term care for an aging population. What many other states are looking to do is to do what we did 10 years ago, which is to move to care that's community-based, that people prefer, that's more cost-effective, and that keeps people at home. And, his comment was, he's really glad that the rest of the country is doing that. He said, now, we're looking to you to help us figure out what's the next iteration of where the country needs to go. Because he understood that we did all this 10 years ago, and we still are going to be facing some of the same issues of increasing older population, increasing need for long-term care, and what we as a state are going to do to address that and hopefully lead the nation. And I think that that's in many ways what we need to do as a Department of Human Services. Is
Dr. Cole?
Yes.
In light of your previous couple of sentences, does this mean then that if they're going to or seeking to learn to model what we're doing, that they are currently spending more money for the services they're providing seniors than we are?
other states?
Yeah.
Chair Jensen, I'll let James Faze give you the exact figures, but my understanding is that generally it is more costly to provide long-term care in an institutional setting than it is in a community home-based setting, and that those states that have more and more individuals in institutional settings spend more per individual than in some of the other settings. So
I understand that institutional care is the most expensive of the services that are provided. But just because it's the most expensive services provided doesn't mean that they're spending more money than we are. They may not be providing the services, or that we're not providing. I mean, there are lots of other variables that go into that, and that's what I'm looking for.
Chair Jensen, I stand corrected. Let me restate my answer. I don't know.
Thank you. We'll look forward to a more detailed explanation.
Indeed. Well, on that note, because it's probably an appropriate note to end on, let me stop and see if there's any questions.
Whoops, same turn.
Bruce, what is DHS plans right now for the seniors and the baby boomers who are going to be reaching retirement age, who are doing that? What is your plan right now, looking forward?
Chair Jensen, Representative Garrard, I'll let James talk about that in depth. He's got the most familiarity with that. We have right now a group looking at this as a large task force with community partners, helping us figure out exactly what we need to do and where we need to place our efforts to meet this. And some of the themes that I know that group is working on right now is certainly issues around long-term care insurance, issues around how we integrate some of the physical health care and long-term care needs of many of our seniors, so that we can look to put manage services as a complete package, so that health care services and long-term care services are integrated together. There's some very good models, both in this state as well as nationally, as to how to do that. To look at how we can improve upon community-based models of care, to look at some of the federal policies that we would need to be able to institute some of this. I think those are some of the themes at a high level that we're looking at. I'll let James get into some more detail about that.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Goldberg, my office has tried in the past to obtain information from DHS about the numbers of clients that receive publicly subsidized health care. I have been told from different venues that the state actually tracks this information, but when my office tried to obtain it, they were told that the information doesn't exist. And if I'm totally off base, that there's no public value in having this kind of information, please tell me so. But I would think that it would be very useful to have.
And Representative Witt, exactly what information? It was information about
clients in Oregon who receive publicly subsidized health care, both federally and state subsidies.
Well, that would... We're the ones that would be providing that. So I would think we're the ones that could provide you with that information. I would think it'd be very, very valuable information. And let's talk afterwards, and I'd be happy to get you that.
Thank you very much.
This is part of transparency.
Sure.
This is part of being able to establish the effective working relationships together that help us do the work. We've got to be able to provide the information. We need to be accountable for what we do. That's my pledge to you. And let's work together to assure that. If we're not doing our job, let me know. I'm glad you did. And we'll get you the information that you need.
Thank you very much.
Question?
Okay, well, that ends my portion. We'll have James come up and now talk about seniors and issues in that regard.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, James Tate from the Senior and Disability Program at the Department of Human Services. It's a pleasure to be here. What I'd like to do is do sort of a high-level overview of the Senior and Disability Program, both describing how we're organized, the types of services we provide, how the budget is divided, how we rank nationally in expenditures, and I'll spend a chunk of time on the long-range planning we're engaged in right now. The governor, in his budget message at the beginning of this biennium, charged us to really start looking at the aging demographic and how it will affect Oregon in particular, as well as the rest of the country. And so we're in the middle of a very extensive long-range planning process with a lot of subgroups working, and I'll sort of walk you through what those areas are. By way of overview, the senior and disability cluster in the Department of Human Services, when the department reorganized in 2001, we pulled in parts of three different divisions: the Developmental Disabilities Program, which was formerly part of the Mental Health Division; the old Senior and Physical Disability Program, which was a separate division; and then we have a large unit that we contract directly with the federal government called Disability Determination Services, where we, the state, under contract, do all the Social Security and the SSI determinations for Oregonians seeking assistance under those programs. So those all came together under the Senior and Disability Program. I'd like to spend a little bit of time on page 2 in your handouts and sort of begin with where we are nationally, how we got there, and then sort of back up into the big challenges that we face in Oregon. As Bruce mentioned in talking with the regional office, Oregon is still well known nationwide as having one of the best long-term care systems in the country, from a variety of angles. And one of the main indicators of that is the relative proportion of people that are served in community-based services versus institutions, and then how that also translates into costs. In 2004, this is the last national ranking we have, Oregon was still ranked number one in the percentage of overall expenditures that we expend in community-based services, with the other top six states that are ranked there. And as you can see, Oregon at 71%, whereas the national average is about 36%, is a very big contrast in the small number of states that have forged ahead in serving seniors and people with disabilities in community-based settings, and then spending their dollars in that same direction. In terms of, Mr. Chairman, your question, how Oregon ranks nationally, we don't have the latest data, but several years ago, in terms of overall community spending, as we ranked against the rest of the country, we were 8th. In institutional spending, we were 47th. And on per capita spending across the board, we were 20th. That needs to be updated because that's quite a few years old, and usually each of these studies that also are several years old. So that's a bit outdated, and there certainly have been changes in the last several biennia. But I would expect we're still ranking somewhere in the middle of the pack in terms of overall spending, and still pretty high on the community side and lower on the institutional side. Oregon got to where it got over the past 20 years, largely by very clear policy direction that the Oregon legislature set, beginning in the early 80s. In the early 80s, Oregon passed some landmark legislation that is still some of the best you'll see in the country, that integrated all parts of long-term care into the same policy area and field structure. The Medicaid program, the Older Americans Act, eligibility for food stamps, eligibility for health care, all of that was combined under single administrative structures and single field structures, with the original guiding philosophy being that seniors should be able to go to one place and be able to plan and have all of their needs met. And again, it's only a handful of states that unfortunately have been able to achieve that. If you go to most states, Medicaid, Older Americans Act, food stamps, health care are all in different places that people have to migrate through to find the types of services they need. And that's in large measure why Oregon was able to develop such a comprehensive plan, which resulted in people being served in their own homes and in the community. Oregon also was the very first state that used the Medicaid program in non-institutional care. 1981, Oregon submitted the first home and community-based waiver and led the nation in that regard. Most states now have such waivers where they can serve people that otherwise would be eligible for institutional care or nursing care in community-based settings. And Oregon has always taken a very expansive definition of the types of services and the number of people that we can cover under the Medicaid program. So that was also one of the key reasons we were able to move in the direction we did. We also, in terms of the field structure, in most states, AAAs, and you'll hear about this more in some of your subsequent hearings, area agencies on aging that Jacqueline and company represent. In most states, they simply operate senior centers, food sites, small programs of outreach around the Older Americans Act. In Oregon, again, historically and for wonderful reasons, we took a very expansive view where the area agencies on aging could do the full program. So historically, where we had state employees and state field offices, over the past 20 years, the big agencies up and down the valley, area agencies, have absorbed that function. And so now, throughout pretty much the I-5 corridor, local area agencies on aging do the full gamut of senior and disability services. And then on the coast and in eastern Oregon, for the most part, the AAAs are much smaller nonprofits, still do the senior sites and do the meals programs, but the state then, through field offices, does the Medicaid program. But again, this has been a historic partnership that has taken us a very long way. The other historic thing that happened in Oregon was a very aggressive approach in allowing people with disabilities and seniors to hire their own staff to provide support in their own homes, called the CEP program, the Client Employed Provider Program. Other states have modeled this program, but it really was the approach that you could try to find support close to home, in your own family, in your own church, in your neighborhood, and you could hire those people directly, and we, the state, would reimburse through wages and costs that work. And so now, out of nearly 12,000 people that we serve in-home, about half of our long-term care is actually provided to people in their own homes. The vast majority of those individuals hire their own staff with our assistance, and about 30 to 40% of the people they hire are relatives or family members. And again, that's pretty unique nationwide. You'll probably hear later, since that time, through ballot measure 99, the Constitution was amended in 1999 to allow those workers to collectively bargain. So the home care workers are now represented by SEIU, and we now negotiate with that entire workforce collective bargaining package. But the fundamental principle still remains that the client, the senior, or the person with a disability hire their own staff. And that's, again, quite unique in most parts of the country. The other thing that, Oregon did, and historically, which I think was very, very good, is there was a very close partnership between the state and the industry in terms of how we planned public expenditures and private pay options. So when you look at assisted living, for example, assisted living in many ways was given birth in Oregon and has spread dramatically all over the country. But the partnership between part of the expenditures covered by Medicaid under long-term care public expenditures and then opening a wide array of private pay options has really allowed a much broader system than we typically think about in terms of just the who we support through state financing. And that is very, very fruitful for a lot of reasons. But including when you look at some states that have very limited options other than institutional care, if a person, for example, has that traumatic event, breaks their hip, needs to go into long-term care for the very first time, comes out of a hospital after some catastrophic event, if they're still spending their own resources and they go into institutional care, they spend down very, very quickly and then are shifted onto public financing. And Oregon, where you've had a broad array of options, including home care, assisted living, et cetera, allows people through their own at their own expense to go into less costly kinds of settings, which, again, is a benefit across the board. So those are all things, I think, that have contributed to Oregon over the past 20 years being able to set some real forward-looking directions in long-term care. Starting with, I want to give you a brief description of the types of services and the numbers of providers that we provide in long-term care in Oregon. Starting on page 3, is simply the chart, the breakdown on the numbers of programs and licensing licensed beds in 24-hour care, and then the number of people that are served in 24 in home care programs. And the next page will actually show the number of people out of those licensed beds that we pay for. But again, the capacity in many of our living settings and in our providers is much larger from a licensing point of view than the actual number of people that we pay for. And the balance of that is either people that are there in private pay or in parts of our industry, for example, the nursing home industry, where the numbers of people in nursing facility services has declined dramatically over 20 years. In many nursing facilities, you'll see very high vacancy factors of simply empty beds, which has been true for many years now in Oregon. On page 4 is the breakdown of and this, again, these are seniors and people with physical disabilities. We'll get to developmental disabilities here in just a second. For seniors and people with physical disabilities, this is the breakdown as of last July on the settings where they're served, where we pay for it with Medicaid dollars. Again, with nursing facilities at 5,000, trending a little bit lower than that, you'll see assisted living, residential care, foster care, and then you'll see the very large number of people, again, that are served at home in their own program with the home care worker program, and then relative foster care, about 2,000 people where we actually license foster care, where individuals live at home with their own family members, and we pay that through a foster care payment. So, again, the vast majority are served in their own homes with the split then the rest between nursing facilities and other community-based either congregate care or small foster home serving people 5 or less. Page 5 and 6 simply gives the descriptors of each of those different services, which I can go into detail, but I can come back to that if you have any questions. But it is a description of all the different service types that we have in the senior and physical disability program. Starting on page 6 is a description of developmental disability services. And you probably ask yourselves, why do we split or categorize developmental disabilities different than physical disabilities, which are combined in terms of funding and service types with seniors? part of it's historic, the way the department was historically organized, where these services were in different parts of the department before the reorganization. But a large part of that is also how federal financing works. At the federal level, there are very distinct fund sources and regulations that apply to developmental disabilities program that are distinctly different than senior and physical disability programs. In the home and community-based waiver, for example, and I'll go through the budget page in a minute, where we spend the vast amount of our resources for local services, at the federal level, they are distinct waivers for the two different populations. Oregon originally in the early 80s tried to get one home and community-based waiver that would serve all of long-term care. Actually, the waiver we submitted in 1981 did that. In, I think, 83 or 84, the federal government broke that apart and said you have to serve developmentally disabled folks in a different waiver. That's held true ever since. And so for whatever reason, those are still distinct populations under federal law. And as a practical matter, for the most part, they are distinct in terms of how we deliver services. They're different field structures. By and large, they're different provider systems where different regulations have applied historically. I think over time, a lot of that will begin to come closer together, but again, there's long histories of separation between those two areas. On page 6 is simply a rundown of the types of programs and where we serve individuals. Our last remaining institutional facility is at Eastern Oregon Training Center in Pendleton. We then maintain a variety of state-operated community programs, by and large small group homes that were developed as Fairview was closed in the year 2000, and we served in a typical community setting, but with a much higher ratio of staff with state employees, particularly complex people that are very medically fragile or have very significant behavioral problems. The comprehensive services you see there is basically 24-hour care. That's persons with developmental disabilities in group homes, in foster care, and 24-hour settings. Adult support services called STALEY, and some of you have probably heard of STALEY. STALEY was the settlement of a lawsuit, STALEY versus Kitzhaber, that we settled in 2001. It was a lawsuit filed on behalf of families with persons with developmental disabilities where the state had, for many years, had long waiting lists of people that were receiving little to no support. And under that decision, the state acknowledged under the Medicaid program, you have to be equal in terms of how you serve folks, individuals. So we are phasing in. We are still implementing that legal settlement. We will continue to do that through the year 2009. By the end of the 2007-2009 biennium, we will have some level of service afforded to every single person with a developmental disability and their family. The support services simply means this is non-24-hour care. These are folks that still live at home by their families or by themselves. They're not in 24-hour care, and they get a variety of supports: in-home services, chore services, respite care, adaptive equipment, assistance in job location, vocational training. All is in the non-24-hour side, which was agreed to under the legal settlement of STALEY. And then bottom is the types of providers and the numbers that are statewide. Other than the state-operated community programs, most of the facilities are community nonprofits under contract with the state and local government. So it's a very broad network of services statewide. Again, on page 7 is simply...
Before you move on, can you help me a little bit? It seems pretty clear that in your chart on page 6 that the Eastern Oregon Training Center, 42 clients, one provider, and then you've got state-operated community programs, 147 clients and 31 providers. And then you have group homes. Is that comprehensive services?
Correct.
And none of the others there. And then the
And the brokerages are the organizations through which we have implemented the legal settlement that provide the dollars and the case management to individuals living at home with their own families.
Okay. Thank you.
On page 9, Mr. Chairman, the field structure through which all services to this population are delivered are actually two separate field structures, although in some parts of the state they're starting to merge. We operate since, and it's sort of historic back to the old divisions before the department was reorganized in 2001, but we have different enabling statutes which created different field structures in at different points of time. On the developmental disability side, at the field level, we still primarily operate through community mental health and developmental disability programs that are operated by counties, by local, or in some cases, consortium of counties. All of the dollars for these services are contracted through local government and in turn then contracted primarily to community nonprofit providers. The case management, the eligibility, the entrance criteria is all takes place through county government at the local level. On the senior and physical disability side, again, we have in some cases small nonprofits that simply do the Older Americans Act as area agencies on aging, but then primarily the vast proportion of the field are AAAs that do the entire program. Under state law, we require that a AAA or an area agency on aging that also operates the Medicaid program has to be a governmental entity of some sort. So in some cases, they are counties, and in some cases, counties have gone together and formed councils on government to operate the area agency on aging. Historically, it goes back to the formation of the whole senior and disability program in 1981. Local government was given a lot of choices whether to serve only seniors or senior plus people with disabilities or only the Older Americans Act. It was kind of a big tent at that time. And then the state would provide the backup to whatever was not being provided by local government. But those differences are slowly eroding, and for the most part, either AAAs or the state handle the entire Medicaid program and the Older American Act program. So over time, it's begun to consolidate. And in two counties, I think now, the Developmental Disabilities Program and the Senior and Physical Disability Program are all under the same roof now. So we're beginning to see some movement and shifts at the local government level as they respond to their own critical local priorities. So, Mr. Chairman, that's just the 10,000-foot view of the overall service system, and there's a tremendous amount of data and information behind this, and as you progress through your hearing, so we'll be very happy to provide and drill down with as much detail as you would like in any of these areas. I would like to turn to the issue that you posed, Mr. Chairman, earlier, and that's the issue at hand for everyone, and that's the aging demographic, what it means for Oregon and what we're potentially going to do about it. If you look at page 10, this January, the first of the boomers turned 60 years of age, so we are 5 years out from the entire boomer generation starting to move into Medicare and Social Security and the major entitlements. I was told by our communication staff at the department, we actually know the first boomer that turned 60. It's a woman in New Jersey who apparently her house is besieged by reporters and trying to regain her anonymity. But in any case, the boomers are coming, the wave is coming, and the impact is going to be historic and potentially very troubling unless we do something about it. In Oregon, of the age 65-plus population, based on the population demographics from 2005 to 2025, you can see this simple chart that shows the age spreads of 65 to 74, 75 to 84, and 85 plus. And this is very important because as we turn to the next graph, as one ages, the need for long-term care accelerates until at the point where you're 85 years plus, the need for long-term care goes to about 1 to 2, whereas between 65 and 74 in the earlier ages, the need for long-term care perhaps is only 1 in 5 or 1 in 6. So not only are we aging in bigger numbers, but the oldest of the old will increasingly dominate that population, and that's what has the most profound effect on the entrance into long-term care, and also will have a very profound cost, profound impact on our health care costs as well. There's lots of speculation that the next generation that's retiring will be healthier and less reliant on public assistance, and we all hope for that, but again, when you have the biggest population surge that will be people into very advanced age, it will have a very significant effect on. If you look on page 11, Mr. Chairman, this is national data, not Oregon data from the Kaiser Commission. It shows of all people age 65 in the country, about 15.9% receive some form of long-term care service. And then you simply see the percentage spread as the age increases, where when you get to 85, it's 40%, and 95 plus 72%. So again, that's the demographic wave. It's not just the sheer number of retirees, but it's how that pushes out into the aging dynamic. We expect that our caseloads over the next 20 to 25 years will increase dramatically. And as part of that discussion, the governor commissioned us to begin a very serious long-range planning process. And as Bruce mentioned, ironically, the rest of the country, all they're thinking about is doing what Oregon did 10 or 20 years ago. And quite frankly, I've had aging directors in other parts of the country say to us, we're really, really, really scared if you folks in Oregon are very worried about how you're going to finance your system of care, where you did the right thing and you went to less expensive community-based care, and you're now worried about how you're going to finance that, and yet the rest of the country is trying to emulate what we did 10 to 20 years ago. A lot of folks have said that's pretty scary. But again, the demographic wave, no matter what our service settings, threatens to overwhelm us all. What we have done, we've assembled a long-range planning task force. It's a very large group with significant participation from all the stakeholders. We have about 35 people on the task group. If you go to page 12, Mr. Chairman, I've tried to boil down the whole long-term care, long-range planning exercise into two pages. And the simple premise is that we have a historic long-term care system, the basic principles of which we want to preserve, independence and choice, and providing community supports. But again, our ability, even if there is reasonable economic growth through the next 20 to 25 years, the percentage of the state's general fund budget, even under reasonable economic growth conditions, that would have to be allocated or reallocated to this population, if nothing changes, would be very dramatic. And as we know, in terms of how the general fund is divided in Oregon, that poses a huge dilemma for all of us. We have formed seven separate work groups that will deliver their preliminary recommendations to us in probably March or April of next year. We're planning at this point that we will conduct a series of public forums and hearings all over the state. We don't expect to come up with any cures by that time. We're hoping at least to come up with some key pilots that we could initiate in the next budget cycle. But we really see the long-range planning process as taking place over a number of years, not just a one-year or a one-biennium event. This will be ongoing, but we're hoping at least to set the stage by coming in with some preliminary recommendations. One group is dedicated to research, doing tons of research about the reasons people come into long-term care, as they come in, what are their conditions, when they change, where do they go, to look at the complete flow and the pattern of how people migrate between different services. We're bringing in the researchers, the population group, the University of Portland, their research staff, and we're really trying to drill down on all the different research questions that we have to ask ourselves. We're going to look at healthy aging as a critical part of the campaign. There's lots of pilot projects all over the country on healthy aging. And the research is very compelling and very powerful. If you prevent diabetes, if you prevent obesity, if just basic conditions, if you can mitigate those conditions, the likelihood that those people will need significant support is much less likely. So you have the research and the demonstrations that clearly show that. What the states are struggling with and what we're hoping, we're working with our public health folks and the researchers, is to say, can we take that research and go to scale? Is there a strategy where you could really go statewide with diabetes prevention or other things that would really have an effect on public behavior? And that's always a difficult question. What you can prove in an isolated pilot is difficult to take to scale, but we know we have to look at that, because as people are healthier and able to stay independent, their reliance on long-term care plus their own satisfaction with their lives dramatically increases. So we're hoping to have some clear proposals by spring on that. We want to develop a whole package of very practical assistance to families, both seniors and the sandwich generation, of those of us who are planning for our parents, how to best use long-term care, financial planning, estate planning, reverse mortgages. There are lots of tools there. There's lots of misinformation or no information at all about those tools. Most people, ironically, still don't plan. Even if you talk to 50-year-olds who are working with their 70- and 80-year-old parents, very frequently there's not a long-term plan. Everything kicks into motion when that catastrophic event happens. The person falls, they break their hip, they go into the hospital, and suddenly everything dramatically changes and people are scrambling to figure out what to do. We want to try to put a package in front of people that says, here's all the things you can plan for. Here's how you can arrange your financing. Here's how you can actually select care options, do the research beforehand about that. How you get the public to embrace that is a big question, because we all deny our own infirmities and our own need for eventual long-term care. But we're looking at some very practical tools that can be web-based, that people can easily use, and that we can do a lot of advertising and public outreach to help people begin to do that planning. Our insurance division has done some critical changes in rules to try to make long-term care insurance more practical. There's been quite a bit of reform that's happened in the long-term care insurance industry to make sure that it's viable and that people don't buy in cheap and then eventually their premiums go so high that they can't afford it at the time they actually need it. But again, long-term care insurance may help 12 to 15% of the population, but nonetheless, it's something that's very much worth putting out there as tools that people can use for themselves. So even though primarily we at the state level have evolved into a Medicaid agency where we simply fund long-term support, increasingly we see our mission as very broad outreach to seniors and the population at large, if we're going to help them provide for themselves and also then corral the costs and the expansion of long-term care itself. On page 13, question number 4, we have a group that's looking at a variety of what are called elder-friendly communities that have developed around the country. And you've probably heard little examples of meter readers that check on certain seniors who may not be able to navigate outside their homes, and how can we connect volunteer and other community resources together and actually target people living in their own homes or their communities that can benefit through some kind of volunteer network or assistance and not rely entirely on public assistance. a huge area here in the elder-friendly community thing is to look at architecture and design and home design. So many cases, you know, where you have narrow hallways, narrow bathrooms, you can't broaden them or put in the necessary grab bars where a chair or other things can fit, often can be the precipitating event where a person has to move out of their home. And if we began designing homes, you know, with broader options that people could age in place much longer. Question number five, we're also looking at non-entitlement resources. The Oregon legislature this last session passed the Oregon Project Independence Modernization Act. I think it may not have got as much attention as I think it eventually will, but it really said, where can the state, in one of the few areas where we still spend just general fund dollars, it's not matched by Medicaid, we don't have all the strings attached by the federal government, because quite frankly, in recent years, we chase the match at every opportunity, and of course, with that, we always then bring a whole set of requirements that we have little control over. The Oregon Project Independence Fund we see as a resource that can provide part of the technology and the information sharing with the public to do the planning that they need to do, plus also provide some in-home supports before people need the broad-based long-term care. So if we can do a little bit of long-term care, a little bit of chore service before the person needs an in-home care, live-in worker, and all that, that's a good expenditure, because once you get into the Medicaid program, then that all rolls up across the Oregon Health Plan and everything else that they're eligible for on Medicaid. So we have a separate work group that will just look at the implementation of the OPI modernization, and I know your committee has that on its agenda as well. So we'll be very pleased to discuss options there. Question number six. We have a group that's sort of dealing with the array of service and the choice issue. And this is a painful discussion for all of us. Under existing federal law and state law, if you are eligible for nursing home services, which is the premise on which basis you get entrance into any long-term care, and we have, and we can describe at a later time, we have this elaborate functional assessment in which we measure a person's need for bathing, dressing, eating, mobility, all of those different kinds of things, where we peg their actual need for long-term care. You have to, as a level of care, meet what otherwise would be your eligibility criteria for entrance into a nursing home to be able to receive Medicaid service or the waiver, the home and community-based waiver on the community side. It's an ancient principle in federal law. It's kind of crazy. Everybody knows it needs to go. But as a result of that, the federal government from the beginning has said a person who's otherwise eligible for institutional care, for whom you offer a choice, even in a much less expensive setting, nonetheless can select any of the services, including the institutional care, as a matter of choice. So even though you say, you know what, this amount of service would perfectly meet their needs, if they want to go into a more expensive option under federal and under current federal law, they have the right to do that. And again, as the demographics explode, the issue will be, can we afford that? I think in most cases, people and the case managers working with them make the best choice. And obviously, since most people want to stay at home anyway, they're going to try to choose less expensive options. But as the population really begins to expand and the demand, the issue is, are we going to have to create certain caps or incentives for less costly care? And that's a group that's going to be challenged with some real conflict in terms of choice and principles versus the reality of financing long-term care. The last, number seven, and Bruce touched on this, we really want to explore combinations of long-term care and acute care. For the most part, we finance those in different groups. The providers are different. We have a lot of coordination between our case managers and the medical profession and the acute care profession. But as the population ages, particularly the 85-plus group, we know in many cases that it will be medical frailties that drive the type of long-term care that that person needs. And we also know that cost of care on the medical side for that aging group, that really aging group, is very, very high. End-of-life care is very high. It's a group that tends to go into the hospital very frequently. And we have a lot of data from some of the model programs around the country. We have one in Portland, the Providence Elder Place program, that combines Medicare and Medicaid, and it really shows that if you do very aggressive physician interventions, daily interventions, preventative care, you can minimize or prevent that expensive end-of-life or hospital kinds of care. And so quite frankly, if we look at the system holistically and really target residential care and long-term care settings where that acute care triaging and assessment and delivery is happening at the same time, and then we could prevent the migration into more expensive health care, the savings might actually help materialize on the medical or acute care side that would help offset the costs on the long-term care side, plus provide a better quality of life. So we have one group of doctors, healthcare plan representatives, and other advocates actually looking at that theory and saying, could we end up with almost a single capitated rate umbrella long-term care, acute care combination? That's tricky. It leads us into areas that we've never really explored before, but I think it's something that's worth looking at. So that, at this point, is how we've arranged our research into the future. A lot, also, I should add, depends on what happens at the federal government level. There's been lots of discussion about reforming Medicaid. There's a Medicaid long-term care commission or a Medicaid commission. On the long-term care side, though, at this point, they're really only looking at the margins or looking at tightening up income eligibility a little bit, a little more severe asset testing and things like that. But they're not really looking at sort of the core of what's going to happen to Medicaid and Medicare as this demographic wave happens. And, of course, we're so dependent on these entitlements for our own funding. And if those entitlements, quite frankly, go broke or overwhelmed at the federal level, then what happens here in Oregon? So a lot depends on what happens federally. So we're trying to, again, lay this out. What can we do to refashion and rethink every part of long-term care that we do in this state? And then, of course, we have key people. Senator Smith chairs the Select Committee on Aging in Congress, and so I think that's a vehicle to also work in terms of Oregon ideas that might work at the national level as well. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the last two pages simply is a summary of the budget pie in the Senior and Disability Program. It's slightly over a $2 billion biennial program. It's a large part of the expenditures of the department. And on page 14 is simply the revenue side of it on the left that shows we're very heavily leveraged with federal funds. 60% of our budget comes from primarily the Medicaid program. The general fund you see there. The other funds includes, in many cases, client contributions. All clients have to pay a portion of the cost of their care if they're between certain income levels. And then on the far right, you see the expenditures, which, again, primarily are on long-term care with the other smaller percentages. And then the last page, again, simply shows the division between institutional, non-institutional, and in-home care. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Torres, would you please comment on the positive contributions that you would see the formation of HPSAs having on the delivery of health care to senior citizens?
Mr. Chairman, Representative HPSAs, I'm blanking on that.
Yeah, it would be a designation. I believe it's a federal designation for areas that are short of doctors.
Okay, I wouldn't be able. I think Dr. Goldberg or someone could probably respond to that better than I can.
Chair Jensen, Representative Witt.
HIPS is a health professional shortage areas, and their importance is that physicians, my understanding is that physicians in health professional shortage areas can get an enhanced reimbursement rate from Medicaid as well as from Medicare. And one of the big issues that's facing many of our communities now is it's become increasingly difficult for individuals on Medicare to get access to health care because of some of the inability of Medicare to keep pace with reimbursement. Medicare reimbursement rates are low, Medicaid reimbursement rates are low, and as a result, in order for many facilities to stay in business, they manage their patient mix. It's making it harder and harder in some communities for seniors to get access to care. What HIPSAs do is, in those areas, it allows for additional reimbursement and helps to provide access to seniors. So HIPSAs are one of the things that can help improve access to care for medical care for seniors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Goldberg, you told me that you'd help me get some information on subsidized health care, and I was wondering if you might also assist me with the formation of HIPSA.
We have an office that does that provides technical assistance to communities to do that, and we'll be happy to put you in touch with them.
I'm in need of that assistance as well. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Done.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how to really answer. This is not a hypothetical case. It's a real case. It occurred Sunday in a traffic accident that I was responding to as a firefighter. And my patient, 72-year-old woman, 73-year-old woman, very active, healthy, lives alone. She is now, her life is going to change, and I don't know what her financial situation is or anything, but is she going to have to spend down all her own money? You know, this would maybe be I know there's insurance issues also, but will she have to spend her own money before she can get any of these assistance programs, whether or not she can live with a family member or have someone live in with her to help her rehab? She has massive injuries in her leg, basically, and a neck injury. But she'll be in therapy for a long time, many surgeries, et cetera. What do we have for someone like that who is independent, has their own, you know, is she going to have to spend all her own money and not have anything left to give to her daughter? When something like that comes on so suddenly. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, it's a complicated question, and without knowing exactly her circumstances, first of all, let me start. To be eligible on the Medicaid side, to be entitled for long-term care in Oregon, which is by and large a Medicaid program, we're a 300% of SSI state, which means the income limit to be eligible for long-term care is $1,600 and some, roughly in that neighborhood. And you can't have more than $2,000 in assets, excluding some things like you can still own your own house and car and a few other kinds of things. But that is the basic eligibility for long-term care. If private insurance, and in many cases, you know, her private insurance may cover a lot of the therapies and things like that. Again, I don't know. But for non-Medicaid populations, that historically has been the Oregon Project Independence. I mean, that's been the only other vehicle we have that could provide a little bit of in-home support and care. But obviously, if her injuries are of the magnitude where she may need a live-in or a full-time caretaker or even for, you know, one shift or two a day, you know, those expenses will very quickly eclipse what the Oregon Project Independence Program could pay for. And so, yeah, eventually, depending on whether through a course of rehab and her private insurance, if she can't make it back to a certain level of independence and eventually will need long-term care, yes, she would then have to begin to spend down. The other thing that you should know is that Oregon also has when you talk about whether there will be something left for her heirs, Oregon also has a fairly aggressive estate recovery program. So any person that that enters long-term care in the Medicaid program actually have to sign that that their estate will be liable for the costs eventually after their death. And that's a big disincentive. Many seniors really recoil at the idea of having to sign that, but that's both a federal and a state requirement. And again, Oregon sort of leads on the amount that we recover in estate recovery. So it is very difficult for someone who has been independent and fully reliant on their own resources at that point in time if they will need full or extensive long-term care.
And just a follow-up comment. This woman is one of my constituents, too, turns out. And she, it seems unfair, I guess, to say someone who's spent their life maintaining their health and their independence and staying working all those years to stay off public assistance and now is going to be put in this position to have to take it because she'll lose her home, you know, she won't be able to live alone anymore where she lives. So, thank you.
Representative Gregg.
Mr. Toews, I'm fascinated by the idea that back in the early 30s when we started the Social Security program that somebody picked 65 as the day we become seniors based on the fact that nobody was living to be 65 back when they did that. On your page 11 on your chart, share of people age 65 receiving long-term care, it's interesting that until the age of 80, less than 5% of the population over 65 needs long-term care services. I guess this is just a hypothetical question to you, but could the answer to some of the economic challenges that lie ahead, not only in this state but in this nation, come back to looking at why the hell we have 65 as a retirement age?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Girard, it's even for the Older American Act services, actually the age of eligibility is 60. So we have a sort of a disconnect there as well. You venture into dangerous territory when you talk about Social Security and reforming Medicaid and Medicare, but something will have to be done. These major entitlement fund sources will absolutely go bankrupt. When you and I've looked at as we've gone to national symposiums with aging directors and economists and others that sort of lay this whole thing out. When you simply look at the accumulating debt load that will translate out, it's frightening. It is actually very frightening. And the politics, of course, of what to do are equally difficult in terms of do you change the age of retirement? Do you begin means testing certain parts of Social Security and Medicare? I mean, those are all very challenging political issues. But if we do nothing other than just raise taxes geometrically to keep up with the growth of these entitlement funds, it's not going to be sustainable. And I think there's a lot of concern that the direction we're going now and just letting it get worse and worse to a point where it'll be very difficult to turn around and fix it. But I think we will have to look at retirement age, and we will have to look at financial eligibility as we go deeper into this.
Quick
follow-up.
If the federal Social Security program should go belly up, would then the burden of the entire senior program fall to the states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess if the states embraced it. Again, I mean, if you look in theory, all of our entitlements are rooted in federal law. And so if the federal Medicaid program or Medicare or others simply went bankrupt or ceased to exist, then essentially our programs are structured around those entitlements, and how we fund, how we match with our general fund dollars and fill in behind is really part of that. I guess what would happen is the states, based on their own resources without federal match, would begin to rethink what level of support they could provide. But again, we are so dependent. I mean, looking at our budget, 60% of our budget in long-term care is all federal dollars. So if those entitlements unravel, we're in a world of hurt. But sure, states, I don't think there's anything legally that would say the state has to pick up the slack. But of course, from, I guess, morally, I mean, if all our seniors were ending up on the streets, it would be a very, very, very tragic situation. So,
just your long range scenario goes to 2025, and that's somewhere around the period that now comes into question between 2025 and 2040 in regards to the funding of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. So there's so much of what, I mean, there's just so much of what you can plan for based on the fact that the federal program continues the way it is. But if anything happens at the federal level, it's going to pretty well toss any state plan right out the window. Is that being considered at all in the long range?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. I mean, I think what we're trying to look at the state level, I mean, to some extent, we're assuming that those entitlements will still exist, and we're basing our plans on that. But we're also saying to ourselves, even if those plans continue to exist, the amount of general fund growth that Oregon would need, if we kept basically the current mix and match of services and the way we fund them now and simply laid the aging demographic on top of that, the general fund requirements for Oregon will far exceed what we'll have available even in a reasonable economic growth pattern. So that 800-pound gorilla is on our doorstep already without even figuring out what the federal government will do. So I think to the extent that we can increase personal accountability and other options for people and look at medical care and do the things we're talking about here, that will help in any scenario, but unless the issue is resolved nationally. I mean, the good news is that everybody's talking about it. The National Governors Association has, and the outgoing chair, the governor of Idaho, had really prioritized this and said this. Everybody talks about tsunami waves now, but this really is coming, and it will absolutely sink us if we don't do something. So I think the realization is there, but at least I don't see anywhere any formulation of a plan that will really begin to address this. And in many ways, I think our heads are still in the sand for what's really coming our way.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Sorry for the type of question it is, but
it's a very difficult question.
Representative, yes, thank you for that question. And I would point out that you and I can feel, pretty good about this whole thing, that we are doing our part, the two of us here, to move this age out the other way, a little bit older. I mean, we've taken this high-paid job that you now are, here for to kind of help in a microcosm solve this problem.
Mr. Chair, I knew I would feel better after having this task force meeting today.
My other committee's emergency prepared.
Yeah, question. Sir, I begin. I'd be glad to yield to you.
Sir? I'm sure you'll cover it.
On what we're talking about, one of the things that I think would make this even more graphic for us, and I don't disagree with anything that's being said about what this is going to cost us, but if we take that original chart that you have with the demographics and hold all other variables constant for just the change in the age demographics for the and realize that's kind of a phony sort of way to do it, and look at the percent of the gross domestic product of the state of Oregon or any other state that is going to be needed to take care of these services versus the amount of our gross domestic product that today is being spent for these services. I think we'd probably find that it'd be somewhere in excess of 100% of the gross domestic product by the year 2025 to continue to provide the same services. And that's just a quick...
It's a good point, Mr. Chairman. And part of our research group on the long-range plan committee is actually trying to develop a couple of models that can take the demographic and the economic impact and actually chart them together. So they are somewhat flawed, but I think it will give us a good picture.
I think it's imperative that we get a good picture of this as not just the legislature, but as the people to realize that there's somehow we've got to find some other way to do business on this and I'm not sure what that other way is, but I am sure that, you know, that this is not a sustainable situation that we currently have. I have a lot of other questions, but in both the interest of time and of waiting for more detailed discussion on some of the projects and things that we'll be doing, I'll save those for today, and we'll proceed on if there are no other questions for Mr. Caves. Thank you.
Members of the task force, while Judy's coming to the table, I'm just going to pass around the member chart and ask you to review the information on here and give me more pertinent information or accurate information so that getting a hold of you during the interim will be very easy.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is a test.
Not really.
To see if we know who we are.
Okay. And where you want to be found.
Judy, proceed at your discretion.
Okay.
Do we want to take a short break here before Judy begins?
Yes.
Give you a chance to stretch and whatever. Is that all right with you? I mean, we don't want to...
Mr. Chair, that would be great.
Thank you. Yeah, well, sir. At ease.
We'll stand at ease momentarily.
Some of us older women might go break.
The House Interim Task Force on Seniors, and we are ready for a presentation from Judy Moore Pearson on numbers.
Thanks. Numbers.
Please proceed, Judy.
For the record, members of the committee, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the administrator for the client caseload forecasting team. And just as a slight introduction here, I've been on the job as a veteran here for 2 weeks longer than Bruce has in this particular position. So I'm still learning as well, although I've worked for the department for a number of years. So what I was asked to do is provide an overview of our process for caseload forecasting in general, and then at the conclusion of that, go over some of the high points of the fall 2005 forecast for seniors and people with disabilities. So that's what I'm going to do today. The PowerPoint slides that you should have are cover the overview of the process for caseload forecasting. I'll also review some of our methods, and then I'll go into the program area. So a little background, as a unit that's devoted to client caseload forecasting, it's only been in existence since mid-2004. Prior to that, client caseload forecasting was done by program people as well as budget folks. And the unit was established to help establish an independent process that would use kind of standardized forecasting tools, statistical modeling, et cetera, and then also that a process would also be put into place that would include review and oversight of the process and of the forecast itself, et cetera, by forecasting experts that are outside of DHS, and that process would be continually modified and evaluated. on the hard copy, that's going to be very, very small print. But what I tried to do is provide an overall organizational structure. On the left-hand column is our actual unit. We have three forecasters who have a different area of the department assigned to them. So Kevin Hamler-Ducroix does children, adults, and families. Kush Shrestha does seniors, people with disabilities. And then Stephen Wilhite does health services. We also have some research analysts who help work with program experts as well as do some research on national and state trends that may be, influence the DHS forecast. Within the department, we also have program steering committees that are devoted to each one of those areas. They're made up of program staff who are experts in the area, as well as DHS field office staff, budget office staff. We also involve a legislative fiscal office and administrative services and the budget and management staff. The external review comes in two different groups. There's a peer review group, which is made up of a variety of forecasters and people with expertise in the trends, et cetera, in Oregon, ranging from the state demographer to the state economist, some legislative fiscal office staff, and some private industry folks who work on forecasting issues as well. We also have contracted with the technical review team to work on the actual technical aspects of the mathematical models that we've put together. One of the goals was to gain, is to have expertise in forecasting come on board and be part of that unit. And so we looked for people with the forecasters with both an educational background as well as a professional background in forecasting. And the forecasting background ranges from both within sort of similar populations, for example, with the Department of Corrections, there's some similarities there in the way that the populations may move in and out of program areas, as well as forecasting within the private industry, health insurance, and other kinds of industries. So they come with a great deal of education and professional experience that I've been working on for the past year on developing the different forecasts for the different units. So these are the DHS programs that are forecasted. We do not forecast at this time within the unit all DHS programs, but we do try to do the majority of them and the ones that have the largest populations or the largest, perhaps, budget impact. So, for example, within children, adults, and families, it's broken up into self-sufficiency, which includes food stamps, the TANF programs. It also includes child welfare and then vocational rehabilitation. Within health services, we do medical assistance programs, which is the Oregon Health Plan, both the PLUS and the Standard, and there's a small group of other kind of medical assistance programs as well. We also have started to work on mental health and addiction services. That's still at its beginning, so you won't find that in the forecast books at the present time. We're still working through the methodological issues with that program. For seniors and people with disabilities, we do in-home, community-based care, and nursing facilities. And not all of the programs, some of them are not included in the forecast here. These are programs at the present time that we are not forecasting. So the two of the programs that are within the seniors and people with disabilities is that we don't forecast at the present time developmental disabilities, and there's some long-term care services that we don't forecast at this time. For example, nursing facilities, extended care. The reason that we don't has to do with that we're still kind of at the beginning stages and learning how to forecast this in the most accurate way that we can. Started with the programs that were the largest. With developmental disabilities, that's a slightly different example. The data that is needed for the forecast isn't readily available at this time. The department is working on a new data system that hopefully will be completed relatively soon, and then we can look at what it would take to forecast that population as well. methods. Forecasting, as you may imagine, is both an art and a science. And there's a multiple methods in which you can choose to do a forecast. There's dozens of mathematical formulas, different modeling systems, different simulations. Forecasting for social science, such as DHS populations, tends to be more difficult than in the physical sciences, although, as I was reminded this morning by Representative Jensen, those in the physics area have their challenges as well. One of the reasons for those difficulties is that the more factors that end up influencing your populations and the quicker those populations change, the more difficult it is to forecast them, especially out 2 years, 4 years, or 5 years out. You can forecast broad trends, but getting it down to really, really precise is tends to be difficult. Best practice for forecasting within populations like DHS populations is to use multiple methods, which we do for DHS. We'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. We have been contacting and other state social service agencies to talk about what methods they use, what are their accuracy rates, if they'd like to share some of their experiences or if they would like to form a group to talk about sort of best practices. And what we have found is that there's a great deal of variation, but it tends to be about plus or minus 4% overall for the large populations. There's a great deal more large variations within the subgroups. Some states for a one-year time period may have just plus or minus 1%, and others may have much larger variations than that. Most states have been challenged with the predicting the Medicaid population as well as the TANF population, so there's a lot of work to be done in that area, not just within Oregon, but also nationwide. I would like to cover a little bit about the various factors that do influence DHS populations. You've already heard about quite a few of them with the earlier presentation with James on the demographics. But there are a number of other factors that do influence DHS populations. The economy is one that has a dramatic impact on DHS populations, although it's not a one-to-one correspondence of, you know, if you have economic improvement, then you have an automatic drop in DHS populations. One of the reasons for that is that while growth, for example, in Oregon has been improving, it's not necessarily in the areas that, for example, provide health insurance or they tend to, perhaps they are low wage jobs in the service sector, or as in the front page of the Oregon or the Statesman Journal today, in construction work, which may not provide many health insurance benefits. So it's a combination of job growth, the types of jobs, what sectors they're in, the benefits, and the wages that all have an impact. And then sometimes it takes a while before that translates into reduced caseloads on DHS for those that are poverty-related. Demographics, we've heard a lot about the demographics. In the very near future, we're not expecting the dramatic growth in the age populations, but as you've heard, within 5 to 10 years, it's really going to start to grow, and then by 2014 to 2025, you're going to see dramatic growth in the age of those populations. And again, how long people are living, how soon they come into the long-term care system, how healthy they are, all of those factors influence DHS populations in general and the seniors population in particular. Within the health insurance market and also the long-term care market, we've seen dramatic changes over time in those markets, and they actually have an influence and an impact on DHS populations. Even, for example, with the nursing home facilities, people are not only choosing not to go into nursing home facilities, choosing other kinds of options, but they're also staying for shorter periods of time in nursing facilities, which also tends to reduce the nursing home caseload. other dramatic impacts on DHS populations are policy changes. One example has been the cut in OHP standard that took place. That's had dramatic impacts on a variety of different populations within the within DHS, not just in the OHP standard. Policy changes at the federal level with the Medicare Modernization Act and the prescription drug information that's coming out and the outreach efforts that have gone on to low-income seniors, those have an impact on DHS populations. Welfare reform that took place in 1996, again, federal policy changes have dramatic impacts on DHS populations. And how those policy changes take place and how they're implemented, for example, within DHS, business practices have an influence on how many people are on the caseloads. Also, outreach and education efforts, again, if you have major outreach efforts on food stamps, for example, that's to the general population who are hungry and need food, but that does lead to an increase not only in the food stamp population, but as those applications are reviewed for other social services, then that can lead to increases in other caseloads, TANF, the seniors population as well. Individual and cultural behavioral changes, we've talked a bit about those, and for example, people choosing to not go into a nursing facility, trying to stay in their home as long as possible, wanting to not be a burden to their families. As those individual behavioral choices change or shift, it does have an impact on what winds up coming in the door for DHS services. So given all of that, I did want to go back to the particular methods that we use for DHS forecasting. We use both our science and our art. Our science is we use the simulation modeling, which has dozens of mathematical formulas that then are kind of chosen as to what's the best fit, what do we think is most likely to occur. And the art of it comes in talking with program and technical experts on upcoming trends, on, for example, what historical periods look like they are going to be replicated or not going to be replicated. And then genius, believe it or not, this is actually an official forecasting term, genius. I kind of like it, and it's that relying on kind of the intuition and the expertise and the experience of the forecasters themselves in choosing the best models. And we use that combination.
There's a very fine line, I think, between genius and okay.
Right. And hopefully we can figure out what the difference is.
Yeah.
So, with our mathematical modeling, we base it on historical patterns. And what the models are tracking is the number of clients are coming onto the program or into the various programs, how long they're staying in the program, and that's important if you think about the nursing home stays. If they're staying for less period of time, then you have a lower accumulation each month or as time goes on, or counter that if you have a lot of clients who are staying for longer periods of time, then you have an increase in caseload because you have more people on each month. And then it also tracks the clients transitioning among the related programs or leaving the programs entirely. I mean, they're not on DHS programs. Many of the factors that I was talking about that influence DHS populations are indeed very difficult to actually build into mathematical models. This is one of the areas that we're diligently working on, particularly in the area of seniors. We're working with those long-term care, long-range planning groups that James was mentioning earlier. We're active participants on those and trying to help contribute to that and sort of doing some of the modeling that we were talking about, that you were talking about before. In other words, if nothing changes and you just have the demographics or just the disability, what do you think the demand for the service is going to look like? What is it going to look like on a going forward basis? We're trying to contribute to that and try to help refine those models. What kind of services are they going to be using, depending on what age group they're coming in? And since you kind of have some demographic forward thinking on what those age groups are going to look like and how many people are coming in, you can do some prediction on the demand side, even if you can't necessarily predict what part of the system they're going to go into. And in the back of your forecast book, the one that says aged and physically disabled, at the very back of that is a report written about some progress that was made prior to the forecast on what is called exogenous factors and some of those factors that aren't within the DHS influence necessarily. So what do we do with those various factors that may be influencing DHS populations? Well, when we do know mathematically how they might influence it, we try to build that into our modeling and simulation modeling and bring those to the program and the technical experts. When we don't know necessarily what the quantitative effects will be, we try to do some of the research on the trends, the national trends, the state trends, what's going on within a department to help provide some context or some information around that forecast that you may see that can provide some idea of what like a risk to that forecast might be. That these things are coming up and you need to know about them coming up, but they're not necessarily built into that mathematical model. We do that with both using the consensus of the program experts as well as the technical experts, as I mentioned before, the research on national state trends. That's the last slide on the overview of the forecasting model. And I thought I would, if I can, go into the long-term care side of it. This will be actually relatively brief. There's three main program areas that we cover. For those people who may not have the forecast book in front of them, this is where you can obtain it. It's on the DHS website under the finance and policy analysis structure. As I mentioned, there are three main areas that are forecast, and this is actually in your books. So the first one that we're going to be talking about is the forecast for the fall 2005 time period in the nursing facilities. And if I'm here, it's going to be on page 19. Oh, first of all, this is just to demonstrate that what was talked about earlier is that the bulk of the long-term care services that we're looking at are actually in your licensed community facilities, the community-based care. Second is the in-home care services, and then the fewest people are those who are in the actual nursing homes or nursing facilities. So this is the nursing facilities chart. And I do want to say that I know there's a lot of lines on here, and the original audience was for those program experts, so and I did not have a chance to modify it, but that's the chart that you're also looking on page 19. And if you're looking up there, it's green line on my screen here. That's the fall forecast. If you look at the scale, you'll see that the scale on the left-hand side goes from 3,000 to 7,500. We don't use a zero-based scale because we want to show where the differences are, so that's why that kind of emphasizes the change over time. And what you've seen is a slow but steady decline in the nursing facilities. It is the curve downwards is not as... it looks like it's leveling off, but it still continues to be a downward decline. And that is both a factor relating to fewer people going into the nursing homes, choosing other options for their long-term care, as well as shorter nursing home stays. At some point, we don't know where that balance is going to be, as whether it's going to even out, but that's one thing that we're watching very closely. For the in-home care, what you see here is a dramatic rise early on in in-home care services with a very precipitous fall in January through the first part of the first part of 2003. And that's directly related to the cuts in the service levels that were made at that particular time period. They were made in service levels for those people who required fewer long-term care services, and so it makes sense that that occurred in the in-home care services area, in which the majority of those people, that's where they were, had been receiving their long-term care services. You've seen it kind of in general level out, and that's what the forecast is also showing, is this a kind of continuation of a leveling out since that time period.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you. If I might ask just a clarifying question. Mm-hmm. The caseload that you're talking about here are actual patients covered by your services. It doesn't reflect the need that exists in the population.
That is correct.
If we had a chart of the need, then we would not see a decline and a leveling off based on the information that Mr. Hayes showed us a little while ago. We would see the need increasing, and if we showed the uncovered need, that would likely also be increasing.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, that is correct. This is not projecting what the this is representing the people who are on the caseloads and predicting who's going to, how many people are going to be on the caseloads being provided these particular services on an ongoing basis. It is not reflective of the demand or the need.
May I ask a follow-up, please?
Please.
Thanks. What kind of assumptions, then, did you make about the resources available? Because that has to influence how much of a caseload you can support. As you look out into 2009, what assumptions did you make about budget authority that would be able to provide service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, we actually didn't make decisions on the resources or the budget authority. The 0709 is not based it's based on the idea that the service levels, if they were to continue at the same level, that's a prediction. Now, the further out you go, the less, the more variability that you're going to have. I wish I could claim credit for this, but I can't. But someone was describing it. It's like the headlights on your car. The closer you are to right in front of the car, the more accurate you can be. The further out you go, the more difficult it is to predict. The more wide variation, the wider the range of the variation is going to be. And so when you get out to that 0709, that is based on the present historical factors and the idea of what those present services are. It's not based on what the budget authority are or what the resources are.
You're holding those variables constant.
Right.
Thank you.
Since the question somewhat appeared here, and since it's a further question that I have, I'm having difficulty accepting reliability of the material, especially in light of the fact that we're showing a dramatic increase in the population. In fact, if we just look at a kind of an average based on figures that have been given us today, we're going to increase that population roughly 15,000 a year, 150,000 in a 10-year period. Okay, 15,000 a year. If you increase the population by 15,000 a year and hold the services, you know, constant, where are those other folks at? I mean, my brain tells me that unless you've made some significant, what you talk about in your thing, policy changes, you are going to have some kind of an increase. It may not be dramatic, but it's going to have to be some kind of an increase if you increase the population. Now, it may be that if you take into consideration, if you've done this, the socioeconomic status, and make the assumption that this new baby boomers that are hitting the thing at a higher rate, at a dramatic rate, that they are in the higher socioeconomic status, you may be able to explain away, you know, the decline in the need for services. But something seems to me has to take place there. Mm.
Mr. Chair, I'm actually really glad that you asked that question. One of the nice things about what you're doing is you're actually planning for the future. That major growth in age groups isn't occurring in the next 2 years. It's occurring, in fact, there's a negative growth in some of the age groups in the elderly population between now and 2010. And so the major growth that you're facing is actually at least 5 years out. In some of the younger populations, for example, the 65 to 69, you will see some major growth by 2010, but it's not by 2007.
Well, the chart we had is 2000. It's on 10-year increments, 2005,
right.
2015, 2025.
Right, and I have another one, which I can provide to the committee.
I assumed a linear pattern there, which I understand may not be correct.
Right, that isn't what's happening. That's what you're seeing is
so
symptomatic growth,
a
little bit further
growth
out.
After some period. Mm-hmm. Here.
Right, and that's what we're trying to work on is in trying to predict that those features.
Could you, in some future things, correct that for us so that we're looking at
more near term.
Well, at more what is actually going to take place. I understand, you know, where you're going, where your projections are, mm-hmm. but all I'm saying is that if I go to my constituents and try to explain it on the basis of this, that the information is not going to be consistent. And
so which part of it did you want me to correct?
Well, I'd like to know, what the actual projected...
With the demographic
population 65 plus, I think,
right.
is where you start in.
Right. We'll be happy to include that.
From now till sometime off, 10 years after eternity.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, James Tate, if I can make a real quick comment. When you see that line trend down through 2002 through 2004, that again, a lot of that was the five special sessions,
right.
Yeah.
And we know what happened is we suppressed demand significantly.
Yeah.
The word was out there. We scared the heck out of seniors and people with disabilities, and they have not come back in big numbers. So I think that's part of
what we did.
Yeah.
I understand that, but I'm looking at we're just taking the projections from January
right.
2005
right.
to January to July 2009, and I'm seeing something of a decline of probably around 700, give or take a few, there. I appreciate that spike over there has some other dynamics
mm-hmm.
that go with it.
Back to my last.
Thank you, though.
Then the community-based care, the green light is actually showing an overall average increase over time. And again, that's those are the nursing facilities that are not the nursing facilities, but those are the long-term care services that people go into instead of going into nursing homes, or they have that option. And that's the largest of the various long-term care service areas. I think that's my last. Yeah, that's the last slide. Did you have?
I didn't mean to interrupt your train of.
No, that's fine.
A thought there. Have you finished? Is that?
That was it. That's my last slide.
Okay.
I'm done.
Representative Witt, I see your hand was looking like it wanted to go up. Is that? Do you have a question? Or?
Mr. Chairman, you're reading my mind. Thank you.
That's scary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Should I tell him what you're thinking, too?
No.
He always thinks kind thoughts.
Bless him.
The green line that we were just seeing suggested an increasing long-term demand, and yet at the same time, I'm hearing anecdotally at least that there are significant hours being cut by the folks that provide the services. Is there any accuracy to those anecdotes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, we've heard that as well, and we don't have any data that shows that. We've been quite willing to try to research into local areas where those concerns are being expressed. We do know that as part of all the reductions that happened, we really tightened up. Well, first of all, we cut the eligibility levels, but then we also tightened up how we administered eligibility and how we assessed, and really focused on accuracy. And as part of that, because people are annually reassessed in this rather elaborate assessment methodology, and so I know in some of those cases people are being assessed and are being told they're eligible for less amount of service or hours than they were previously, because their previous assessments were too high. And so there certainly has been fallout with that, but at least we have not seen an overall dramatic trend in huge numbers of hours being cut, although I'm sure that plays out in individual cases.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just concerned that we may have a developing needs gap at this point, and I don't know, you know, how we address that if, in fact, it exists. So.
Yeah. And we're quite willing to look at, try to pull up other data sources again to see, but at least from the data we've looked at, it does not appear that system-wide that we're dramatically cutting hours. But again, whether that's happening in some select areas or certain or for individual clients, I just can't say.
Okay. Thank you.
That's right, Bart.
I just wanted to take the opportunity as a former radio announcer, I pride myself in correct pronunciation of last names, and I wanted to apologize to you because earlier I called you Mr. Toes, and it should have been Mr. Tays, and I apologize for that.
Representative Girard, I think I called you Representative Girard, so
I don't think we got reciprocal.
I think we're even now.
Mr. Chairman, my apologies, too. I made the same mispronunciation.
Yeah, he was the main reason.
Chairman, you would not know it from the spelling.
Now, there's no way your last name should be pronounced Tays, but if I keep talking, I'll be apologizing.
I could give you the explanation, but it's 400 years worth of tortured history. So.
Is it
just
Welsh?
Just like health.
Yeah. Is it Welsh?
No, it's actually Dutch.
Oh, Dutch.
Prussian, Russian, Ellis Island.
Oh, one of those. Cutting off the piece of the hand to fit the pan. Long story.
Okay. I'm not going to that one.
I thought you would. You are going there. Okay. Okay. I'm sure that we'll be back visiting the forecasting, and I suppose I have to apologize to members. I don't know whether you had a copy of this before you arrived today or not. The chair did, and I had the misfortune of having to read it before I got here. So.
I think I did. And I actually looked at it, and I was...
Yeah,
to say that I always wondered how you came up with what you do. So, and you remind me of my statistics professor at Portland State. So.
I hope that's our favorable comparison.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I was always impressed.
One of the things in the previous session, we had some discussion about the variables that went into the forecasting, and it was pointed out that policy is that, you know, one of the things that will influence what we have as far as actual numbers out there. And
Mr. Chair, I have this comment on statistics.
Yeah.
Statistics tell you that if you put 1 foot in a bucket of ice water at minus 40 degrees and the other foot in an oven at plus 40 degrees, statistics tell you you won't feel anything.
I didn't ever learn that one, but that's a good one.
It's bad when you have to explain them.
Solid block of ice on your foot.
But a lot of work has gone into it. And I would also, I don't know whether this was mentioned well enough as we were going through this, I'd like to comment on the methodology that you know, Judy has said that she's kind of short time on the job. It's probably important to note that the department she's now in, as she's indicated, is relatively new. So this whole methodology of forecasting that she's talking about is we don't have any real existing data to compare it against what its track record is. We can compare it against what other projections were, but we can't compare it against what it might have or it projected on those. So it may mean for us as legislators that while this is developing, we have to be a little bit patient with the forecast and realize that the agency is going to have to be learning as they go along a little bit with this. So, and we would at least hope that the advisory committee or whatever they refer to them that they have, that at least some of the members there are more accurate in making these projections than they were in making projections as far as the economic growth of the state of Oregon has been over the last decade. So with no other discussion, unless you have something final that you'd like to bring to us, we'll end that portion of it. And I think we have some people signed up for public comment, and I have John Mullen, and I assume Jacqueline Zimmer, and something about a panel here. Somebody couldn't write it very well, so somebody spelled it over again. But I believe it says panel.
Mr. Chair, Scott Vaughn was to have joined us, but he had to leave. So I'll cover his comments.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I'm sure he's put his comments in able hands, and so please go ahead for the record.
Duly authorized to ramble on his behalf.
Until I dash bang the gavel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, also known around the building as O4AD. And with me is John Mullen, who is the director of the Clackamas County Social Services, my area agency on aging director in the Clackamas County area. And we have a series of comments to make about what you've heard today and a few comments to make about what you'll be addressing in your upcoming meetings. And so I'll just proceed with some of these comments, and then if you have questions, I'd be happy to entertain any of those. And let me tell you first that what I'd spent the morning on, this morning I spent almost the entire morning working on providing Oregon Public Broadcasting with a series of people that we call BBACs. And those are people that we know when we're cutting them off from services that they will be back. And for the most part, they'll be back at a higher level of need and care, even if after we've cut them off of Medicaid services, they've fallen into our safety net Oregon Project Independence for a while, that at some point, for the most part, when you cut somebody off of Medicaid at survival priority level 14 through 17, they will be back. And I had no shortage of profiles for OPB to work from. And at some point in the future, when you're talking about the area agencies on aging or our system, we'd be happy to provide you with some of those cases. But you don't necessarily see those kind of things reflected in this 30,000-foot view you've gotten of the forecast for seniors and people with disabilities. And I think it's one of the most critical pieces because it drives the funding, but it also drives the staffing and the workload for our people out in the field. And I'm not certain that I completely understand the methodology used to create this document. I applaud anybody that went through statistics, passed it, and stuck with it. It was the downfall of my GPA in college. But for us, I think a report like this treats people as widgets. There's no true range allowed for how many people might be in your caseload, and I think Representative Nolan was sort of leading you there, and so were you, Mr. Chair. The projections and the demographics for seniors and people with disabilities goes up. It's common knowledge that it's going up, and what you're looking at today is a methodology based on the 2003, I think 2005 caseload, which has been artificially reduced by, I'm sorry to say, the legislature. And not that it was your fault, but that's one of the reasons that the caseloads have dropped, and then it creates this cycle of VBACs. And so we haven't really been able to, I don't think, produce adequate projections for you anywhere in our caseload. So the Department of Human Services is going to come before the emergency board in January. They're going to let you know that caseloads have gone up and that they don't have the resources to cover those. This is an example of why those caseloads go up. I think another example of why you see caseloads change and not become adequately, not adequately forecasted are the ballot measures that come out. Even if the ballot measure seems to reflect something good for seniors and people with disabilities, in the end, they generally come with no funding, and then we have to provide for services that really should have been given all along. We just have to keep splitting the pie over and over again. And I really think that I look forward to when you have a discussion about caseload forecasting that actually includes all the other exogenous factors that they told you about today that they've not included in this. And I don't know if you're tracking what I'm saying. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Exogenous?
Yes.
It just means all that other stuff. It's a pretty great word, and I had to practice it a number of times because when you first say it, it comes out as something else. But I wanted to look real smart, so I practiced it. So anyway, there are so many factors that just aren't included in this, and I think that having these folks come back and talk to you about real caseloads, I think, is going to be critical as you're planning for the future. A couple of other things I wanted to talk to you about are I touched on the workload and the impact on the field, and when you make drops in caseload projections or you cut caseloads, then you have a corresponding cut in staffing. And when you cut staffing in a field that's actually where people are coming back in and needing services again and caseloads are growing up, what you've done is thrown out the certified SMART people, left some people unemployed, and then at some point you're going to put out a call for people to come in and apply for the positions that you've closed because the caseloads have decreased because the legislature's decreased. Do you know what I'm saying here? So I think there really has to be some consideration for the impact on the field in these particular cases in this particular area. And John will talk a little bit about workload simplification, and that is a potential subject matter for you. You'll see that. I know I'm kind of prowling a little bit, but I wanted to make you aware that we have, I think, over around 500 people in the field of aging and people with disabilities that have been cut in the last 5 years. And there's an incredible impact on the area agencies on aging in particular, because we do provide the bulk of the services on behalf of the Department of Human Services. And we, as you know, we have that famous equity issue where our offices are being paid 80 to 85 cents on the dollar to do the same work that the state does and pays itself completely for. So I'm hoping that this committee will consider the equity issue as you're going through this process as well, because if we're going to provide great service to people and we're going to help them make the best decisions and the smartest use of their funds and our funds, you actually need the staff to do that, and you need to be able to pay the agencies to have the staff on hand if you haven't fired them already, if you're following what I'm saying. So we have an equity issue that factors into all of this forecasting as well. One of the other things I'd like you to consider in your time, this committee would look at the Meals on Wheels reimbursement rate issue for area agencies on aging. We do provide that service statewide, and it's been a number of years since we've had an increase given to us for that service. I think we're being paid around $5.25 per meal is the total rate that's being allocated for Meals on Wheels, and there have been some studies done that show that there's some disagreement, but maybe $1 to $2 more is really a realistic rate. And so we'd like the committee to consider the Meals on Wheels rate issue there. And then the last thing I'd like you to think about as you're serving on this committee is, and I know you're going to talk about Oregon Project Independence, and what a thrill it was this session to see a 60-0 vote in the House on Oregon Project Independence Modernization Act of 2005. We're grateful that you locked the OPI funds up in a trust fund. We're afraid of the next Department of Human Services rebalance, and one of the things historically that's happened in a rebalance is that the department has taken Oregon Project Independence funds to help balance the books. As far as I know, they will not be able to do that this time, and so we're grateful. We are full steam ahead in our agencies, letting people know that Oregon Project Independence is available again. There are a number of people who are, and James mentioned this, scared about using our services because they've been trained to expect that we're going to take it back from them. We've told them a number of times in the last 5 years that we're coming after their money and their services. But we are working very hard to get everybody that's eligible for Oregon Project Independence back into Oregon Project Independence. So the one fear we have, I guess, is that next biennium, the governor will put out a recommended budget. More than likely, if history is our teacher, will zero out Oregon Project Independence. You will need to make sure that there's adequate funding in it for next biennium. In the bienniums after that, hopefully there'll be funds in there from the Senior Disability Property Tax Deferral Fund that will be a stable source of funding in the future, but for now that's a growing fund, and we don't have access to the first $5 million of it anyway. So that's just something to keep in mind when you're discussing OPI here during the interim. So those are my comments. There was a lot to comment on, and I'm sorry. But
thank you.
You're welcome. Jacqueline.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen, Director of Clackamas County Social Services. Make my comments very briefly, not to repeat some of the things that Jacqueline has said, which are very important issues for all of my colleagues. I've been involved with the long-term care programs and human services programs for 30 years in Oregon. Back in 1977, when I was running the Oregon Project Independence Program, it was a relatively simple program to run. And from a client's perspective, it meant that because it was simple to run and there was less paperwork than there is now, that I could actually get out and see my clients on a regular basis. When we take a look and step back from issues of quality, when we're looking at a system and what we're trying to build in as far as quality is concerned, all of you had some very tough decisions to make over the last couple of biennia. There's just not enough resources to go around. Oregon is still looked at, as James Taves talked about, as the model for how to do long-term care and how we are able to serve more people at less per capita cost and by emphasizing community-based care. In Clackamas County, we made a decision after the enabling legislation in 1981 to take over the services that the state administered, to combine our area agency on aging services. And unique to our situation, we also merged in the Community Action Agency. So we focus on issues for elderly, people with disabilities, and low-income people. But again, around that issue of quality, when you look at what you try to do and you look at industry discussion about quality, they talk about structure, process, and outcome measures. What's happened structurally in our system over a period of time, and structurally meaning buildings and telephones and the people that are required to provide the services, is that we have squeezed the number of staff people in our system almost unmercifully. Every day, questions come up from staff about, tell us what things we don't have to do any longer. And because these are entitlement programs, we can't say, well, it's okay if you don't assess every third person or go out and reassess, or it's okay if you let these benefits lapse that would go to a client, because we're very client-focused. But structurally, with having the number of staff we have 12 vacant positions, and we had to lay off 16 positions in this most recent round of reductions. The next step in looking at quality is looking at process issues, the procedures, the way you get work done. If anybody stands back and looks at how the system has changed in a while, it would just take your breath away about how complicated it is now to actually connect people to services, all of the processes that are required. And this is not because James Taves is sitting back inventing new ways to torture the field. These are requirements that come from decision makers, policy makers, most notably at the federal level. We hear over and over again the whole mantra of accountability that is actually beginning to look more and more at process issues. When we come to the third stage of looking at quality, outcome measures, which is the way the state used to look at things very, very much so in the early days of the long-term care system, we said, we want to be able to guarantee as much independence as possible for people. In Clackamas County, when we took over, we had 803 people in Medicaid nursing home beds in February of 1982. We now have about 360 people living in Medicaid nursing home beds. That's a reduction of more than half because we focused on community-based services. That outcome is nothing short of miraculous when you compare to the rest of the country. The state of Oregon has done a fabulous job along those lines. So when you think about the next places to go and the next things to explore, there are a number of positive signs, like Oregon Project Independence Modernization was a very good policy step on behalf of the legislature. We're very grateful for that. But basically, one of the tenets of Oregon Project Independence Modernization is to tell people that the system's not going to be as generous as it once was. It's lost its preventive end. You're going to need to be prepared with things like long-term care insurance, staying in better shape, making sure you don't anger your natural supports, like your family members, so that there's somebody to take care of you. I tell my daughter, for example, that I'm happy that she stays in good shape so she can carry me from room to room when I need it, when my time comes. But basically, we have lost a number of services in the last number of biennia, and that's been talked about. And it's a danger sign to think about where we might head in the future, as we prepare for the people that are to come, and you've been talking a lot about that today. There are fundamentally a couple of choices about that. You can thin the soup, shorten the line, one way or another to look at it, to have less of generous benefits, or to cut more people off prospectively who would be eligible for services. I just had the opportunity, and I'll wrap up with this remark, I just had the opportunity, a great opportunity, to spend 2 weeks in China. China has a lot of things that they're struggling with, a lot of problems. One of the things that I found resoundingly said over and over again is the respect for elders. And I hear it here in the halls of this building here about how often legislators talk about seniors and people with disabilities and saying we need to make sure that we're preparing adequately, that we have adequate services in place. The Chinese are also looking at this. They have the fastest growing elder population in the world. They'll soon have more people that are over the age of 60 than we have in our entire population in the United States. And they're talking about things that they need to do, like repairing benefits, pensions, making sure that there's access to health care, emphasizing exercise, those kinds of things. So they readily admit, by the way, that their system is far from perfect and that they're still developing, but they turn to the more developed countries and think about what's going on here in the United States, and we had an opportunity to talk about some of the things that we do in Oregon. And I'm still very proud of the system that we live in, but I have to say that if I was the young person that I was back in 1975 when I started out with an idealistic view of what could be done, would I choose this profession now that is increasingly crimped and clamped down by regulation and reduction in services? Would I make the same choice? And I'm not sure I can answer that and understand what my answer might mean, because I'm trying to lead a system that is really actually in decline in many ways. And one final comment about the forecasting is that I'm glad that you're spending some time looking at it, because if that forecasting is in fact off, you know how often it is that during an interim, for example, that we get staff added back when the caseloads go up, like almost never. The money is usually not available as part of an e-board discussion. So in the future, the forecasting is going to be very important, because any miscalculation where staff are already overloaded is going to create some additional problems. But I'm sorry that I went on a little longer than I intended to, but I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Quick question for Jacqueline. Is there a point, and where is that point, where that deferral project OPI, where the deferral program will be able to completely fund OPI? Can you give me that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard.
Well, that'll count against you.
It's a great question. The first thing that has to happen is that the Department of Revenue has claimed the first, I believe, $5 million that will be surplus in the Senior and Disability Property Tax Deferral Fund. And at times, and the legislature has in the last 4 or 5 years taken in $28 million out of that fund per biennium to fund shortfalls in the budget. So we know that the fund can actually, but those were kind of boom years. People were refinancing and paying off, their property tax deferral and such and so forth. So there may be, they're saying maybe toward the end of 2009 there'll be surplus enough money in there to start paying for Oregon Project Independence. So we have just a gap to that gap, I think. So 2009, and then in the 2009-2011 biennium, there should be adequate funding in there.
Follow up.
Did they take the first $5 million every biennium, or just the original first $5
million? Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, and I should have explained, the reason that they want that $5 million is to make sure that they always have enough money in that fund to cover any payments to counties if they're short, or if people aren't paying back, people don't pass away and their estates don't pay back or something like that. The counties need to be reimbursed. So that's a protective shield for them, and I think that that's
that's only that biennium that they want that $5 million, but they'll hang on to that. And if that $5 million should decrease, then they'll want to adjust for that and take more. Some factors to think about, though, there is an interim work group on the senior and disability property tax. It's not a legislative interim work group on that particular issue, and we are participating in it. There's some discussion. There are some people who would like to see the interest rate, which is currently 6%, go down. There's a possibility that people would like to see it go up a little bit. That would certainly help us to have it go up, but then it would harm the very people we're trying to help. So there could be some changes to that.
I've given Sandy a note that one of the agenda items will be to get a discussion from legislators that's going on.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair.
Just a quick clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, when session ends, a lot of the information just kind of went out of my head, too. So I thought we put about $10 million into OPI. 12, was it something? So how does that figure? I mean, you said that the governor would start out with his zero.
Right. This is sort of a story math problem. There is $12 million in that fund at this point, and it is primarily dedicated towards seniors, although the legislature has agreed that people, younger people with physical disabilities, can, as that fund sort of starts building up, we can start adding them, since they are, we serve them both, to the services. But the $12 million is intended to be used this biennium.
This biennium.
Mm-hmm. And so that has been, keep in mind that Oregon Project Independence at its height had $17 million in it. And so we are, and we rode the crest of cuts and we're down to, $6 or $7 or $8 million, I can't remember now at one point. So so next biennium, there certainly will not be enough money in that property tax deferral fund because it was cleaned out this session. So we're starting from scratch. So you put the $12 million in. There's some interest growing from that. But the governor generally zeroes out Oregon Project Independence, and then we say you need $3.9 million in there for maintenance of effort for the federal government so that we can show that we are serving people. And this particular session, there was a math error, and we ended up owing $2 million for Oregon Project Independence at one point. But, so. OPI IOU.
Maybe I should have gone into math. I thought I was pretty bad at it. Maybe not.
Can't be helped.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things to consider when you're doing the budget. So, at any rate, it historically, governors have not put money into Oregon Project Independence because it's general fund only.
Okay. I think Governor Kitts never figured out that I would always add it back in some kind of a bill, and so there was always a convenient place for him to balance the budget.
We have appreciated every of support.
Yep.
Well.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Ruth, is it?
Go ahead.
Shepherd, please.
She's got a coat on. I don't know if she's getting ready to leave.
I told her
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to identify myself as a longtime advocate of long-term care, and I had been on the job or on the scene about 10 years when John Mullen came along, because I'd been appointed by then Governor Hatfield, see I go way back, to start up the state to be eligible for the Older Americans Act, and it's been...
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Well, my name is Bruce Shepherd, for the record, and I'm a resident of Salem. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your time today and for your attendance. You realized beforehand, and I'm sure certainly this afternoon, that it's just a huge, huge challenge. And more than that, it might be the biggest national challenge that we've faced for a long while. And it's going to go on for a long while. And I would just like to share a couple of quick things with you today with the hope that we can come back, because I think it's important that you hear regularly from those of us who are eligible for services for now. I noticed again today as the data came out that I'm in an age group where 1 in 4 will need long-term care services. So my husband and I are working through on a personal level all the issues that I've dealt with since I was 30 years old. And I'm glad to see you here. I hope that your work will focus on policy development mostly, because for several years I was evaluating a comprehensive health program in the Northwest many years ago and realized that most healthcare programs that go long enough have, as Jackman says, parallel structures, side by next. And I was struck last session with how rarely the question is asked, well, where's the state policy on this? Practice has gone on for so long in a good number of these situations that it's hard to know what the state's intent was at the time that the program was developed. And your greatest public service, in my view, would be to really focus on what the public policy issues might be. For instance, is the state going to call on all Oregonians to take care of their own health care finances to the extent that they are able as a part of being independent-minded, historically staunch citizens? Or are they going to realize that the burden on the middle-income families is three generational now, in which the middleman is trying to get a family going and supported at the same time they're looking at college and they're looking at grandma and grandpa who may become dependent and they're torn. So it seems to me that many of those issues that are going to come up should really be headed by the question, what's the policy going to be here, and what do we expect Oregonians to follow? Most Oregonians, in my age group, it is alleged, there hasn't been data about this, it is alleged that we're fiercely independent, and we'll just go the third mile to take care of our own self before we'll dip into what used to be called welfare or the poorhouse. I grew up in a family with 4 generations, and the older generation people kept talking about the poorhouse. And I think that has been a part of our culture here, and we don't know how to do policy decisions until we have another look or a better look at possibly a forecasting that's a poll, actually, that says, what do Oregonians believe? And do they know how much they will need home care or long-term care? Do they know that long-term care only applies to about 16% of the total population in Oregon? And do we know, by the way, if that's about right, or is that a little bit too much? So I really urge you and hope that you will hear from all the groups that represent seniors, and I'd like to come back because I've been with those groups a whole lot, and now I have the luxury of coming and going as I want to. I appreciate very much your time. Thank you. Any questions, I'll be glad.
Ruth, we would be delighted to have you back.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say something to Ruth, too. I have a constituent, and Gloria Sheevy, you might know her. She's very active. She lives in Wheeler. And she will be coming to some of these meetings when she can, too.
Those perspectives get pretty, I can translate for you the data that I know an awful lot about and have looked at, and I think it's nearly impossible, Mr. Chair, to put all the actuarials together with a pile of other things and have a bundle that you can rely on to make a forecast for who's going to need care 10 years from now. It's a huge undertaking with so many variables that it's hard to control. But you come to the realization that, as an example, if you can't get up out of a chair by yourself, if you can't do that and you're otherwise going along okay, it becomes an enormous, enormous challenge for care. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to conduct your daily life without getting and remain independent? And who's going to be the helper? Those things are not fragile. They're the hardcore things that we need to look at.
Thank you. That ends our people have signed up for the public comment, so we'll move back to a review and discussion of
yes.
the proposed task force work plan and perhaps the agendas that we might have. And do you have any comments on this, Sandy, that you'd like to keep us on the straight and narrow with?
No, just a reminder that this is a proposed work plan. It's subject to leadership approval. I haven't necessarily gotten that, even though they know we're meeting today and they have this exact work plan in front of them. Just kind of be aware that the number of meetings may be changed depending on the budget of our task force. So we may have to consolidate or not. We might get all seven.
And the one thing that I would like to add to that, to members of the committee, is to look over the task force agenda that we've put together. And if you have issues, if there are areas you want to look at get them to me, get them to Sandy. There's certainly nothing cast in bronze with this that we can't do some other things, but we do need to plan for them. So provide us that information. Yes.
I guess I could just give it to you right now and just say that don't forget, while we're doing whatever we do in this agenda, to consider the rural perspective of all these things. From
one, two.
Yeah.
With the chair from Pendleton, I think you're
just had to say.
Please don't forget the inner
urban
city.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Half of the decisions
we will try not to.
I just like to get it on the record.
But thank you, Debbie. Appreciate that. I suppose our mandate there is, and our obligation there is to recognize that as the agencies deliver these services across a diversified state, different delivery mechanisms may be appropriate in one setting as contrasted to another. And the problems in one setting may be very different than the problems in another. Though there is a commonality in all places, and that's people that we're dealing with. So,
Mr. Chair, I see that you are tentatively looking at a meeting in January. Are you focusing on any particular date yet so that we can start planning?
And that's where, Mr. Chair, I mean, if folks have a calendar and we want to put out as many future meetings as possible, I happen to have packets of blank calendars. I just don't know if you have your personal schedules with you. Just to add, we are, as I mentioned at our morning meeting, we're competing with Marion County Courts for room availability, as well as our own legislative other committee obligations. So the sooner we can get our meetings out there future, the better off we are of having good hearing room and facilities. Otherwise, we could
be shuffled off into a smaller room or whatever, just because of the demands and the limitations on our rooms. So if we want to throw out some dates now for January, I certainly have, or you can email me, as was a suggestion earlier, email what dates don't work for you, and then we can build on that. So whatever the task force wishes to do, I'm prepared.
Let me say that if we want to set the dates in stone now, I suppose I can live with it. But I think the easiest way would be to for you to look at your calendars when you get home, or have staff look at your calendars and send Cindy the dates that you cannot attend, so that we can block those days out. And then we can look at the dates that my other committee will be meeting, and we can look at the dates that Representative Girard's other committee will be meeting. And as indicated, we would like to back-to-back those committees so that we reduce as much as we can the travel time and also the per diem costs that are involved. We may not be able to do it in 100% of the cases, but we would like to be able to do that. And sometime in the next, if you could do that, sometime in the next week, I think Sandy has absolutely nothing else to do.
That's right.
So we would try to set some time. The January is thrown out there. It is not absolutely essential that we meet in January. That's not the point. But if we are going to meet, we are going to have to plan it now, as you had just indicated. One other item before you go, and you are 5 minutes over what I had allocated as time, and my apologies for that. I would like to ask you to look at your area agency on aging in your community and find out what's going on with OPI in your community. The utilization, how much are they utilizing it, what kind of caseloads do they have, and what has been the effect, I suppose, of this uncertainty of funding for them? If you can, a few minutes talking to those folks might give us a lot of information that will be very helpful for us. And if you have any questions, I'll pass them on to Sandy. And if you don't have any questions, we're done.